Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Advanced Biofuels Association preview on the 2014 Renewable Fuel Standard conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct the question and answer session. If you have a question, press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Also, if you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, the president of the Advanced Biofuel, Mr. Michael McAdams. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Angela, and good morning, everyone. My name is Mike McAdams, and I am the president of the Advanced Biofuels Association. Our organization represents nearly 50 companies that produce advanced and cellulosic biofuels as well as renewable feedstocks. Most of our members are focused on producing drop-end fuels that are totally compatible with our existing pipelines, fuel pumps, and engines, and most importantly, circumvent concerns about the so-called blend wall. I'm glad you could join us today's conference call on the Renewable Fuel Standard, or the RFS. As everyone on the call no doubt already knows, the Environmental Protection Agency recently unveiled a proposed rule that would slash the 2014 requirements for advanced biofuel. These are the renewable fuels that have been certified to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by at least 50% compared to gasoline and diesel. EPA announced it is considering a range between 2 billion and 2.5 billion ethanol equivalent gallons for the advanced biofuels pool in 2014, and has proposed $2.2 billion as the volume target for next year. For comparison's sake, 2.2 billion gallons represents a 20% reduction from this year's advanced biofuels requirement of 2.75 billion gallons and a greater than 40% cut from the 3.75 billion gallons contemplated by the RFS statute. When this proposed rule first leaked in October, ABFA did our best to give the EPA the benefit of the doubt. I said in our blog at the time that this is tough to imagine EPA actually proposing such a woefully inadequate target, and that if it true, the proposal would be a devastating blow to many companies working today to fulfill the promise of the RFS by raising capital, building manufacturing facilities, and actually producing advanced biofuels that cut greenhouse gases in half compared to gasoline. Unfortunately, the leaked document proved to be more than just a rumor and wishful thinking. It's closer to being our industry's worst nightmare. If EPA sticks with anything close to the 2.2 billion gallons in their final rule, the agency will have pulled the rug out from underneath the developing of the advanced biofuels industry sector and destroy this industry. Let me be clear that this industry is here today and investing for tomorrow. Innovative companies, including two you will hear from in a couple of minutes, have responded to the challenges by producing cleaner low-carbon fuels and by spending a collective $14 billion in the United States over the last 6 years on the development of the advanced and cellulosic sectors. But EPA's proposal will devastate that progress and chill any future investment. Fortunately, it is just a proposed rule. There's a 60-day comment period that will end on January 28th in 2014, and EPA is holding a public hearing tomorrow in Crystal City, which we will be actively engaged in. It is a voluminous proposal, and we are still digesting many of the details, but three quick points are coming into focus that ABFA will stress in our future comments tomorrow. Number one, EPA's proposed RFS reductions fall disproportionately on advanced biofuels. I'll say again, that EPA is proposing to cut the volume requirements for advanced biofuels by more than 40% when compared to the requirements written into the statute. In contrast, EPA is proposing to reduce volume requirements for conventional biofuels by less than 10%. We're left scratching our heads and wondering why EPA would deliver such a disproportionately large blow to to the category of renewable fuels that reduces greenhouse gas emissions the most. It's unfair and counterproductive to the Obama administration's stated goal of reducing climate change. Number two, EPA's Monte Carlo model will always rule snake eyes for the advanced and cellulosic biofuels industry. That's because EPA's proposed methodology for setting upcoming RFS targets looks backwards at the average of historical data rather than forward to the future production levels. For our evolving industry, such a policy will ensure a continuous oversupply of advanced biofuels compared to what the EPA model forecasts. This imbalance, in turn, will crater the value of the renewable identification numbers that are assigned to each ethanol equivalent gallon of biofuel. RIN prices are instrumental to financing the development of the future advanced and cellulosic biofuel facilities, and the agency cannot support the emergence of a low-carbon innovative industry by looking through the rearview mirror. Number three, EPA should set RFS standards that encourage production and consumption of all available advanced biofuels. There are no other fuels available today that deliver greater reductions in greenhouse gases than advanced biofuels. For an administration that is committed to addressing climate change, this proposal leaves low-hanging fruit still in the tree by setting consumption targets below available levels of the advanced biofuels, plus the carryover RINs. As I said, ABFA takes issue with EPA's Monte Carlo model, but even using the agency's lowball estimate, EPA predicts up to 3.23 billion gallons of advanced biofuels will be available next year. This estimate is in line with ABFA's conservative forecast that our industry will generate at least 3.2 billion RINs in 2013 that qualify as advanced biofuels, exceeding significantly this year's target by at least 500 million gallons and generating many carryover RINs for 2014. Keep in mind, this administration has spent over $500 million from the Department of Energy alone to develop the advanced biofuels industry. To preserve the value of those investments and to continue to support new advanced biofuel production, EPA should set a 2014 advanced biofuels target that can be met and exceeded by current production plus the carryover RINs. Anything less and requiring production and consumption of all available biofuels will be a step backwards from the Obama administration's commitment to reduce climate change. I'll conclude these opening remarks by underscoring that EPA's proposed rule is a significant departure from previous RFS proposals. It is also a departure from clear congressional intent to steadily increase the target for advanced biofuels year over year. This reversal, such as EPA's proposal to put the target below the current production by torturing a model or flipping the agency's own arguments on labor authority, is a major violation of the statute and the commitment of Congress and the administration to create an advanced biofuels industry for the future. I've just previewed the message that ABFA will deliver to all during our testimony at EPA's public hearing. Now I'd like you to hear directly from two ABFA member companies who will describe how this proposal affects their operations and business plans. First, I'd like to introduce Stu Lamb, President and CEO of Viesel, a small businessman that's delivering significant gallons today in the state of Florida, not from one plant, but from two operating facilities. Stu, I'm glad you could join us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike, and good morning, everybody. My name is Stuart Lamb. I own a biodiesel plant down here in Stuart, Florida. And I've been in the biofuel business for over 7 years here, and we decided about a year and a half ago to embark on building a biodiesel plant using a very special process that would revolutionize the way you can make biodiesel. And what we've done here is we are using resins and enzymes in a way that's going to revolutionize the process necessary to make biodiesel out of waste products such as used cooking oil, We could use trap grease. We could use any junk type oils and greases to make a very inexpensive biofuel, biodiesel, and make it cheaper than anybody else in the industry, and therefore produce gallons into the public domain at a price that would be more than competitive than anybody else in the United States. This process, by the way, that we're using is unique, and that we are the only people in the world today that we know of that can use this process of enzymes and resins to produce an ASTM specification 6751 biodiesel at a competitive price that is probably cheaper than anybody else could produce in the United States. We're very, very, very proud of that. We employ 45 people. We're a family business. We're here in a sleepy town in Stuart, Florida. Now, I embarked on this process to find this unique way of making biodiesel because I thought it was the right thing to do, and because I thought it was part of my continuing service to this country. I'm an ex-fighter pilot out of Vietnam, and I appreciate, and I certainly think that providing service to our country is the greatest thing that I could possibly do. And therefore, I embarked on this because I knew that there was an RFS2 program in place that would enhance my ability to be successful. Without these mandates, without this criteria, without this support from the United States government, I cannot make this fuel and put it into the marketplace and compete with major oil companies. I just can't do it. And I can't provide a cheap fuel. I can't provide a fuel that meets the criteria of the RFS2 without these mandates. So how do you start something like this? I'm a small businessman. I had to go out into the marketplace, and I had to go out and borrow some money to get this process started because the United States government says to me, look, if you can meet the mandates, if you can meet the mandates that we have for the criteria in the EPA puts up for the fuel, and if you can meet those criteria, and if you build the plant using your money, we will supply you with the guarantees from this RFS2 program to make you successful. But you have to go into the marketplace first, and you have to build the plant. You have to hire the engineers. You have to put the people on the ground. You've got to build the plant. You have to make the fuel to meet the specification, and then we will give you the support necessary for you to succeed. So I went to my bank. I went to a small bank here in Florida. I said, look, here I am. We have this great opportunity. We have this great opportunity to provide service to our country here and to do something to build a nice facility here that will employ 45 people. They said, fine, Mr. Lamb. And they said, okay, we think this is a great idea, but you know what? We need to see this support that you're going to get from the government. So I pulled out a piece of paper, and on it was the RFS2 program. They said, let us look at this. And they went and they researched it. And they said, and they came back to me and said, you know what? Because of this, and because of your integrity, and because of your good name in this community, we're going to jump on board. And they did. And we built the plant. And we built a beautiful plant, and we've got the technology that works. We're making gallons every day. We met the standard. We met the standard. We met the standards of the EPA. We met the standards of the Treasury Department. We met it. And once we met it and we made our gallons, we were proud. We were proud people. And then we find out that the mandates aren't there anymore. They've changed the rules. But wait. I built this plant. I hired the people. I put the boots on the ground, and I made my commitment work. And it's not for what we did wrong. And it's not because of our inability to meet the commitment that we can't succeed now. It's because the United States government has changed their commitment to me. So now what do I do? I have to go to the bank and say, look, When I signed on these documents, I had an applied co-signer in the RFS2 program. I had an implied partner, but the partner is gone. And they look at me and they say, well, we're sorry. We're sorry. But we're looking to you to pay this. And guess what? I'm in a difficult position now. I'm in a position where I, without this support, without this RFS program, we face bankruptcy, and I may have to put 45 people out of work. So how do you think about this? Yes, Mike?
Thanks, Stu. I really appreciate that. And we appreciate your being on the call this morning. That here in a moment, the reporters on the call will have an opportunity to direct questions to Stu and the other speakers. But first, I'd like to turn the floor over to ABFA's chairman, Wayne Simmons. Wayne is the president and CEO of Sunrock Fuels, a company headquartered in Colorado that plans to use biomass and natural gas to produce renewable gasoline, diesel, and aviation fuel. Wayne is actively fundraising to build Sunrock's first commercial production plant in Louisiana. Wayne, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike. As this year's chairman of the association, I represent almost 50 companies, many of which are trying to finance new plants, just like we are at Sunrock Fuels. The industry can't grow without financing for new plants. This is a capital-intensive industry, and as such, it requires debt to finance these plants. Lenders are, by their nature, very risk-averse. Hence, to promote financing of new plants and build this industry, Congress created the Renewable Fuel Standard to create economic incentive for investors to put equity into advanced biofuels companies and to reduce the financial risk for the lending community. The primary vehicle for providing this economic incentive is through the Renewable Index Number, or REN, which is attached to each gallon of advanced renewable fuel that's produced. Now, the value of the REN that's priced in dollars per gallon is set by the marketplace based on supply and demand. EPA sets the demand each year through the renewable volume obligations, or RVOs. When EPA sets the RVO, or the demand, less than the supply, the REN value plummets and the intended economic incentive disappears. This is exactly what's happened with this year's proposed RVO rule. You remove the REN value, you remove the economic incentive, you remove the willingness for bankers to lend, you remove the ability for the industry to grow. This is what's happened at our company. Raising large amounts of debt to build new plants is a difficult ordeal, even in the best of times. Like buying a house, you'd like to spread the payments over a long period of time for these type of capital plants, like 20 years. Hence, lenders want to see a stable economic incentive through this REN value over that period of time. Now, Congress tried to create this in the renewable standard with increasing production targets for advanced biofuels over time, creating this required demand. However, when the EPA can come along in any year and set demand under the supply, they totally undermine what Congress intended. How do I go to my bankers and convince them that this stable economic incentive is going to be there for all this period of time? And that's a challenge that we're faced with and that we have to rectify. Back to you, Mike.
Thanks, Wayne. Our final speaker before opening the floor to questions is Pavel Molchanov, Senior Vice President and Equity Research Analyst at Raymond James & Associates. Pavel, thanks for joining us today. What does Wall Street think about EPA's proposal?
Mike, thanks very much. I've covered the biofuel industry, both first generation and second generation, going all the way back to 2006. So what I want to do is just frame some of the issues here from the perspective of investors and the capital markets. So there are two aspects to the RFS which make it fundamentally different from what many people are familiar with at the state level, which is called renewable portfolio standard. So there is no renewable portfolio standard federally, but 29 states have a policy along these lines that requires electric utilities to have a specified portion of their electric power coming from renewable sources. So how is the RFS different? Well, for one thing, the RFS has an arbitrary and artificial deadline, and that's 2022. Beyond 2022, the RFS officially sunsets, unless extended proactively by Congress. In 2007, there were 15 years to go. Even that was not a particularly long period of time. But now there's only 9 years to go until 2022. And it's not a matter of, you know, which party is in power, but simply the fact that until and unless Congress actually votes to change this, the fact of the matter is banks have to assume that the RFS will come to an end in 2022. They cannot afford to say hypothetically, well, we'll simply gamble that it will eventually be extended. And because many of these projects are 20-year projects that require financing not over the next, you know, 5 years or 6 years or 9 years, but 20 years plus, this 9-year cliff that faces the industry in 2022 is distinctly unhelpful from the perspective of particularly the debt markets, but also the equity markets. And again, this is very different from the way the RPS policies at the state level are structured. None of those RPS policies have this arbitrary deadline. You know, they have certainly targets by 2020 or 2030, but none of them say you have to reach a certain amount of renewable power in 2020, and then it can go to zero in 2021. That's no one has done it that way. So that's one aspect of the RFS that the industry, you know, just fundamentally finds less than helpful. The other element, which the previous two speakers alluded to, is the fact that from year to year, these targets are not set in stone. They are, in fact, at the unilateral discretion of the EPA, and it's not just a hypothetical concept. The fact of the matter is the EPA set these targets at the beginning of each year, and over the past several years, the tendency has been for the targets to increase. But then in 2014, as you heard the other folks mention, the targets are in fact coming down on a year-over-year basis, which is a first for the EPA. So why is this a problem? Well, because if there is a mandate, and the mandate is effectively set aside by the EPA on this, again, essentially unilateral basis, well, it's not much of a mandate. And again, I would draw a distinction between the state-level renewable power policies and the RFS. To my knowledge, none of the states have made these arbitrary one-year adjustments to say, well, the industry is behind on developing solar power or wind power, so we'll just give them a little bit extra time to grow. Now, the companies are obligated to reach certain targets, and if they do not reach those targets, then they have to move more quickly to get to reach those targets. They don't get a pass, they don't get a mulligan, which is effectively what the EPA is handing the fuel industry, the oil companies. So, again, it's, you know, whether this is, ideal from the standpoint of the oil companies, obviously, is for them to decide. But what I can tell you is from the standpoint of the way the investors think about the stability and credibility of the nation's biofuel policy, both of these aspects of the RFS are certainly not ideal and not helpful at all. Back to you, Mike.
Thanks, Pavel. I'd now like to ask the moderator to please facilitate our question and answer session. Angela?
Yes. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question or have a comment at this time, please press star then one on your touchtone phone. You will hear a tone indicating you have been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Also, if you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question or comment, please press star one at this time. Thank you.
questions, ladies and gentlemen?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Mark Trahan from Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Morning, Mark.
Hi. I wonder if you guys could assess the possibility of legislation on this coming up and how the EPA proposal affects the negotiations in Congress.
Having talked to Mark, thank you for the question. But let me just say, ABFA will, as an association, pursue all options because this we view this proposed rule as very draconian. In my conversations with the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and if you go back and you look at the press release from Chairman Upton and Ranking Minority Member Waxman, they stated last week that they would continue to pursue legislative efforts in the coming year, that there wasn't sufficient time between now and the end of the year, but I'm anticipating that they'll at a minimum have an oversight hearing. I'm thinking probably in February, but I've been told that they will continue to look at this as an option legislatively. Other questions?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Cesare Paruco. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Cesare. How are you?
Yeah, thanks for arranging this. I have two questions, if I may. First, I just wanted to – I know there's a lot of discussion of EPA, and Pavel mentioned that they're using this unilateral authority here to reduce the mandate. But I wonder if you could address some of the factors that the EPA mentioned in its proposal on the 15th of November that they mentioned pretty much, tied their hand, one of them being, the blend wall, which basically, they use as a justification to – essentially set the corn ethanol volumes at 13 billion. And then the other one really being this court case that they lost that requires them to set cellulosic at these, realistic production volumes, which if you follow that logic, would require basically writing down the 1.75 billion and, gets you closer to 2 billion. Yeah, the 13 until you get to about 15 billion, which is what we saw in the rule. What is your reaction to these, constraints that the EPA mentioned in its proposal that really forced it to come out with these numbers according to their logic?
So let me take the second one first. My reaction, and let me say the other members, please feel free to comment along with me. But my reaction is they got it backwards. The advanced biofuels pool in 2013, one of the reasons it's been so successful and exceeded the 2.75 billion number is a lot of those fuels were drop-in fuels and didn't have blend wall issues. And so you actually saw fuels not only come into the biomass-based diesel pool, the advanced pool, but additionally fuels came in this year for the first time because of the value of the RIN in the renewable pool. And these were non-ethanol fuels that didn't have blend wall constraints and that made up for the 500 million gallon gap between the amount of demand for gasoline and the actual statutory mandate for corn ethanol, which was 13.8. So that is one of the reasons we're scratching our head around here at ABFA is you saw demonstrated the statute work, you saw the RIN values work, and what it led was for overproduction of fuels that didn't have blend wall constraints. So that'd be the answer to your second question. Your first question was about the General Labor Authority. Remind me about the first one.
Oh, sure. The two constraints are the cellulosic court case that they lost, which required them to set it at realistic levels, and then the first one is the blend wall constraint.
So I think I've kind of given you my answer on that. But on the court case, I would say already EPA's dealt with the court case. They vacated 2012 in the action that was brought last year, and the proposal they actually vacate 2011.
Right.
And frankly, we're anticipating they're going to probably vacate 2013. So I don't see that as an issue that they need to be crutched on. What really disappoints us here is they got blamed in the court case for putting their thumb on the scale to try to push forward cellulosic fuels. And what they've done here is the reverse. They've stuck their finger in our eye and gone in reverse. So you didn't get it right the first time by trying to over-embellish. You certainly aren't going to get it right by undershooting the stars.
And And the other question I had was, how optimistic are you? I mean, you're going to testify tomorrow, you're going to make the points you mentioned, but realistically, how optimistic are you that, you know, through the regulatory process of, you know, taking the comments and, you know, considering them, that the EPA will change course and come out with a larger advance number for 2014?
I'm an eternal optimist, and I am so convinced that we'll be able, as an industry and individual companies, to make a compelling argument about many things I think were quite frankly not understood well, that we will do everything we can to share that with the entire administration, not just EPA, to make sure that they are fully attuned to the impacts that the current rule has. So I remain confident that we're going to move the needle here. Mike?
Yeah, not just what you said. I don't believe that they understood the impact of this simple supply-demand issue on RIN price and the impact it would then have on advanced biofuels. I think they also didn't really recognize the fact that the advanced biofuels, because most are drop-in, actually reduce the book blend wall issue rather than exacerbate.
So let me give you a specific answer, example, sorry. So let's say they come out with a rule, or let's say they set the cellulosic pool at 17 million, which is the low end of the range they put in the rule. Mm-hmm. And then after they get done setting the range for 2014, they finish the pathway to the rule, which makes renewable gas a cellulosic fuel.
Natural gas.
Okay, cellulosic natural gas. And we know for a fact that there's somewhere around 150 million gallons of that available the minute that rule gets approved. So now what you would have done is you would have set it at 17 million. This is to highlight Wayne's comment, set of comments. You've now set it at 17. Now all of a sudden you've got 150 million gallons off the bat because you've just done a new rule. It swamps the 17 million. It drives the RIN almost to a negative value. So now you've undercut the people that have built the first 17 million by, you know, well, it's taking forever to get the rules done. So, I mean, these are the kinds of issues that we feel confident when they look at them, they're going to have to rectify.
It's about from Raymond James. Let me just add two points here quickly. So, one, just to make sure everybody on the call understands this. When we talk about RIN values, and RIN values can go up, they can go down, this is not a cost to the U.S. Treasury. It's not a tax credit. It's not a giveaway. It is analogous to, you know, carbon credits, which, you know, we have in California, not nationally. Obviously, Europe has carbon credits too. So this is not a cost to the U.S. government. There is no cash cost of the RFS policy to the U.S. government. Zero. And that's a big difference because, you know, of course, the U.S. Treasury encourages energy development of all kinds. So, for example, oil and gas producers receive about $4 billion a year in preferential tax treatment, and that actually is a cash cost to the Treasury. But the RINs themselves do not have any cost to the Treasury whatsoever. And now I'm just thinking about the scale-up of cellulosic biofuels. This is what's exciting right now for the industry, is that a year ago there were zero commercially operating cellulosic ethanol plants in the world, none. Today, there are, if we just look at North America, there are two plants that are commercially producing cellulosic biofuels today. By the end of 2014, based on current timetables, there are likely to be at least four others, so a total of six, and I'm not counting what's being built in Europe and Brazil and so forth. So this is really the emergence of the industry, and while obviously this is happening based on, you know, the innovation and the investment that these companies have done, as I said, predictability of policy is very important to sustain this expansion, because, you know, if banks get concerned about the RFS going forward, it's going to be more and more difficult to sustain this growth rate that we're seeing, you know, over the past year and into next year.
Michael, this is Stu Lamb speaking again. Without the RFS2 program, without the mandates, without a reasonable RIN process, companies like mine, like Wayne, we cannot get financing. There'll be dozens and dozens and dozens of bankruptcies. That's the bottom line. That's the impact of what's happening here.
This is Cesar. Just one follow-up, if I may, for Pavel. Pavel, you cover energy and oil. I mean, what do you make of the industry's blend wall argument?
Well, the blend wall, you know, as you heard other speakers say, pertains specifically to one fuel, which is ethanol. And the issue here, of course, is that most conventional gasoline engines are capable of running 10% ethanol, but they have difficulty going above that. So corn ethanol is not what this call is about. As far as the EPA stance on corn ethanol, well, look, in fairness, in 2007, when the RFS statute was written, the expectation was that U.S. oil demand would grow in perpetuity because it used to grow in perpetuity. Well, it's been down all but two years over the past decade, because of fuel economy and other factors. So gasoline demand is in decline, which means ethanol blending is right at that 10% mark. Now, there are ways past it, flex fuel vehicles, for example, and eventually I think there will be a transition to 15% blending from 10% blending. But in the meantime, yes, there is a blend wall as it pertains to corn ethanol. But that has nothing to do with biodiesel. It has nothing to do with renewable gasoline or renewable diesel or isobutanol or these other drop-in fuels, which are no different chemically from the petroleum refined products that people put in their cars every day. And there is no limit for these fuels. It doesn't have to be 10% or 20% or 30%. It can be 100% theoretically. In practical terms, it would be useless to put it at a 100% level. But I think it's very important to make sure people understand there is a real distinction between what's happening in traditional ethanol and what's happening in advanced drop-in biofuels.
Thank you, Pavel. Angela, are there others looking to ask a question?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Tiffany Stecker from Climate Wire. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Mike. A little bit of a follow-up from the last question. I'm wondering if you think it would be possible or legal for EPA to break down the requirements by molecule, say if the blend wall is an issue for an agency, would they put a cap on Brazilian sugarcane ethanol imports while, maybe having a different number for a drop-in fuel?
I think some people would argue that the way the rules were written, it was designed to try to push some of the Brazilian ethanol out, and that was why that was one of the purposes that they lowered the advance number. But there's nothing in the statute, to my knowledge, that would allow them to select individual fuels. That would literally be picking winners and losers. That wouldn't be a very technology-agnostic approach. Of course, the Congress has the right to do the legislating and create new intent if they were to choose to legislate again in this area. But I know of no such authority where they can pick between various fuels, be it biodiesel or renewable diesel or Brazilian ethanol over one over the other. And, don't forget, the Brazilian ethanol is going to California because it is one of the easiest ways and most cost-effective ways for the state with the single most significant greenhouse gas reduction program in the United States for compliance. So we anticipate that the major oil companies will continue to use Brazilian ethanol irrespective of what EPA may try to do here in terms of picking winners and losers.
If that was the EPA, it's Wayne, if that was the EPA's thought process, they didn't realize reality, because those gallons will go to California regardless, and there's nothing that they can do about it. And I think they're having an unintended consequence of that action.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. Angela, are there others?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Joanna Schroeder from Domestic Fuel. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Mike. I'm curious, you know, obviously there's a huge debate and there's a lot of petitions and letter writing campaigns going on, but it's my understanding that EPA is looking for some really real personal stories. So what kind of efforts and initiatives do you have underway besides obviously testifying tomorrow to get these stories, these individual stories of your members in the industry in front of the EPA?
Well, for instance, Stu, which I thought was a pretty personal story this morning, his representative will be presenting that story tomorrow. But we will be working with all of our members, almost 50 of them, and we'll be working to help them tell that story. Already we've created a series we call it Better Biofuels Moments. And you can go to our website and you can see individual company stories in our snippets. We have five or six more coming out. We'll have a whole series package where people get to talk about, just like Stu did this morning, about the development of their fuels and what they're doing and what we're delivering. Because we're making fuels now, and we're, as Paul suggested, we're going to be making a lot more in the years to come. It's kind of hard to go backwards when you've already spent the money you put in steel in the ground. So I do appreciate the question. Angela, any more?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Jim Lane with Biofuels. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Michael and gang. Just a quick comment there for Bell that the RFS does not sunset after 2022. It goes on forever, actually. It's just they don't have a volumetric standard. The EPA set that afterwards. But, Mike, I had a question for you, which was relating to biomass-based diesel and that number. You've got an opportunity there to take a view on what that number might be in order to, for example, narrow the spread between the advanced biofuel number and the biomass-based diesel number. Many of your members fit into that category. By narrowing that spread, you sort of narrow the opportunity for, let's say, Brazilian sugarcane ethanol to, you know, to sneak into the market through the advanced biofuel pool. Are you planning to take a view as an association on not only advising what, you know, maximizing the advanced biofuel pool, but also on biomass-based diesel number?
I think you should expect that, Jim. What we are, what we've said to OMB and our comments are in public record on that. We're very proud, particularly of the expansion on the renewable diesel side of the equation. You could have significant gallons next year in the renewable diesel space, even above this year. In our presentation, we talked about the biodiesel board believes they're going to produce around 1.7 billion gallons alone. Our members are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 million. So that would be 2 billion gallons. That's seriously above the 1.28 in the statute. And that is one of our concerns with the way they've drawn the number in the proposal for the advanced pool, because the number that they're suggesting is 2.2. And if the biodiesel board alone was to produce 1.7 this year, which they're on track to do, that's 2.55 billion RINs. So you've already blown by not only the 1.28, you've blown by the 2.21, which they suggest in this rule. And that, this is to Wayne's point, which is then you just, everyone knows at the beginning of the year you're going to overproduce, and so the value of the RINs go away. And we think that's an unintended consequence that they need to be very well aware of. So at a minimum, we would like to see them probably push the biomass-based diesel pool up somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.7 billion gallons.
Mike, as a quick follow-up to that, can you comment on speculation that what's driving this is not actually EPA, but OMB, fearing the economic impact is setting a very high number with biomass-based diesel?
The process that was put in place with OMB and all of the other agencies, we've had conversations with all of the folks that were parties in the conversation we had at OMB. The process was a broad process and involved the Department of Energy, it involved the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it involved the National Economic Council, the Council of Economic Advisors,
And I think it's fair to observe at this point, clearly not everybody was on the same page on what should be done here. And so we will, to the earlier question from Tiffany, we will be seeking out an opportunity not only to just simply submit comments, but an opportunity to talk to all of those that look at the RFS from a wide variety of venues, such as economics, such as social costs, societal costs. And what I would observe, if you go back and you read the actual approval of the 1.28 rise in 2012, you will see that the administration dealt specifically with the issues that it now appears they're 180 degrees around from. So that's another reason we're scratching our head, because when you look at what this administration has said previously with respect to denying waivers and rising it to 1.28, a lot of the verbiage that's in the proposed rule is 180 degrees around from what they've said in the past. So, you know, we're questioning why the change.
Hey, Marco, it's Pavel here. Just wanted to quickly respond to the comment about 2022. You're absolutely right that the you know, the statute says beyond 2022, the EPA administrator, in consultation with the Energy and Agriculture Secretaries, has to set the targets. But there is no statutory mandates beyond 2022. And from the standpoint of companies providing project capital, as I said, they cannot have the luxury of assuming what those regulatory mandates will be beyond 2022, so they assume that they will not exist. And that's probably an overly conservative assumption, but, you know, again, having done this for close to 10 years, I can tell you, particularly from the debt financing side and to some extent equity financing, those are the assumptions that will be made unless and until Congress actually intervenes and creates more visibility on what the numbers will be beyond 2022.
Just a quick follow-up to that, since there is no biomass-based diesel target currently in the market, are you saying that all investors zero out biomass-based diesel at this point, since there is no target for this year or any other year forward on biomass-based diesel specifically, or is it just the overall advanced biofuels pool expiring in 2022 that you're referring to?
Well, I'm making a broader observation about the 2022 sunset date.
But there isn't any, there is no, I mean, the biodiesel number is already sunsetted, correct, according to your formula. That sunsetted last year.
Yeah, and they raised it. But you see, the key here is, and I've actually had conversations, Jim, with EPA, and we've actually suggested most, even recently, at our board meeting, that EPA needs to start sending some signals that their intention is for this program to go beyond 2022. And we need the administration to send those signals as a matter of their policy.
And this is Wayne, just to support what Pavel just said, and I've spent an inordinate amount of time on Wall Street over the last year or so in our plant financing. And this ambiguity that we don't even have clarity on this phone call is, you know, from a banking standpoint, when they're looking at lots of different possible investments in lots of different industries and different places to put their debt, when there's ambiguity around this advanced biofuels area, they'll look for a safer, lower risk haven, and that's got to be corrected. Angela, are there any other questions?
There are no further questions in queue at this time. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time.
If not, I just want to say, you know, thanks to everyone who participated in today's call. Expect to hear regularly from ABFA in the coming months as we will be fully engaged. And please don't hesitate to contact me directly if we can be assistance. Thanks again. Thank you, Angela. And thanks all of you for participating. Have an excellent day.